This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
When is a bribe not a bribe? On Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International. Welcome to our newest listeners at WBEZ in Chicago. California Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham, who's confessed to bribery, now faces 10 years in prison. As scandals multiply on Capitol Hill, other Republicans are worried about facing the outrage of voters. On To the Point, what's happened to the party that promised an end to graft and corruption when it took over Congress 12 years ago? What's the difference between business as usual and Cunningham's felony crimes? We'll look at those questions and ask what it all means for national security. On Reporter's Notebook later on, President Hugo Chavez takes control of Venezuela's government. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. Once again, welcome to our new listeners at WBEZ in Chicago. Congressman Randy Cunningham faces 10 years for admitted bribery. What do other Republicans face in next year's elections? On To the Point, what's the difference between Cunningham's crimes and business as usual on Capitol Hill? What does black budget defense spending have to do with it? On Reporter's Notebook, President Hugo Chavez now has total control of Venezuela's National Assembly. What does that mean for U.S. oil interests and its influence in Latin America? First, this news update.
Long live Iraq! Long live Iraq!
Those were the voices of Saddam Hussein and a translator as trial resumed today in an unruly courtroom. Saddam Hussein also declared, "I am not afraid of execution." Howard LaFranchi is in Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. Howard, how would you describe today's meeting? As I understand it, Saddam Hussein was responding to the first witness in the case.
Yes, well, it was a rather chaotic day. There were quite a number of events. There was a brief walkout by the defense attorneys. There was a lot of shouting. There were accusations back and forth. There was testimony from the first witness in the trial. And there was even something very peculiar, I think, for any American. There was Saddam Hussein, the man on trial, really standing and attacking the witness and questioning his veracity, and so it was quite a peculiar sight.
What was the witness testifying to, and how did he act?
Well, the witness was testifying to what he saw in 1982 in his village of Jail, in Iraq, when this is the village where in 1982, when Saddam was passing through, a group of people there shooting out from an orchard tried to assassinate Saddam Hussein. And so later, intelligence agents are sent in to question people. A number of people are rounded up, and 148 people are killed. And those orchards I mentioned are pulled out. And so this witness, who was 15 years old at the time, told everything that he saw and could remember.
I understand his brother was among those killed. How was it that Saddam Hussein then responded to this? And what did the judge do when Saddam Hussein shouted, as we heard him doing?
Well, the judge seemed to, in a way, maybe responding to criticisms that he was not, from some quarters anyway, that he was not holding tight enough rein on the court. He seemed to actually try to put a leash on all those involved, not just Saddam, but also some of the defense lawyers, including Ramsey Clark, the former attorney general. He seemed to, but with the witness as well, at one point the witness wanted a prayer for all the people who were killed in that massacre in his village, and the judge wouldn't allow that. So the judge seemed, at this session of the trial, to be trying to bring a little more order. But he also made a point at one point of telling Ramsey Clark this is not an American court and that things would be done here the way that they are done in Iraq.
Ramsey Clark, as you pointed out, a former attorney general in the regime of Lyndon Johnson. Again, we're talking to Howard LaFranchi, the foreign affairs correspondent who's in Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor. How long now is the trial going to go on? The last time there was a session, it was then recessed for a fair period of time, a week or so. Are we going to see another hearing tomorrow? What's next?
Yes, at one point the judge did say this evening that it would be recessed until Wednesday, but then we got word that was incorrect, that it will take up again tomorrow. I think the point is that they want to have several days of court session this week, because the court will definitely adjourn next week for the Iraqi elections.
I was going to ask about that. Were these proceedings televised in Iraq? Does it appear that Saddam or anyone else involved is trying to have an impact on the election?
Well, that's hard to say. Yes, the sessions are televised, but it's not at all clear that lots of Iraqis are staying home or are glued to their television sets. Many people just seem to be worried about their daily business. There have been a number of demonstrations. I didn't know of any today, but about 10 days ago, there were some pro-Saddam demonstrations in Crete, for example, where he's from. There were a couple of anti-Saddam demonstrations here in Baghdad. And in those cases, it was mostly people saying this has gone on long enough, even though it was only a couple of sessions at that point, and calling for his summary execution. All of the Iraqi television stations do have sort of man-in-the-street commentary when there's either a break in the session or after it is concluded, and most of the people on the street seem to be saying enough is enough. This is making a mockery of our system and all the people who have...
All right. Howard LaFranchi, once again, foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. Back in a moment with To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. California's Republican Congressman Randy Duke Cunningham has pleaded guilty to taking $2.4 million in bribes. All that includes a Rolls Royce, a $7,000 antique toilet, and a yacht as his personal residence. Word of his transgressions first broke when the Copley-owned San Diego Union-Tribune reported that a lobbyist bought Cunningham's house at a price so inflated it later sold for a $700,000 loss, despite California's very hot real estate market. Jerry Kammer writes for the Copley News Service in Washington. Yesterday, he co-authored a story about co-conspirator number one in Cunningham's bribery indictment. Jerry, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren. Thank you.
You write about a defense contractor who knew how to grease the wheels. What do you mean by that? What did he do?
Brent Wilkes found ways to make sure that he got access to the Pentagon budget by way of contracts that were basically ordered by members of Congress. They set up earmarks, special programs that the Pentagon did not request, but that the congressman made sure were put into the Pentagon's budget that benefited this contractor and others of the unindicted co-conspirators in Mr. Cunningham's plea agreement.
You report not only that the Pentagon didn't always request these, but sometimes it was actively opposed to them.
Yes, they said that there was not a great need for this program and that there were other means already online to accomplish what the programs were purported to do.
What were these programs that Brent Wilkes was so interested in that his company was doing?
It was called automated document conversion. It was a technology that has certainly shown a lot of promise and reached a lot of fruition, although not necessarily through the programs that they individually were offering. It converted documents diagrams, blueprints into digital format that allowed them easily to be edited, and that cut way down on storage costs.
But as you report, once again, the Pentagon was doing that in other ways, in other places, with different contractors.
That's right.
So, again, they were arguing that this was useless. How was it then that a man like Cunningham was able to get these programs funded?
Well, it's the magic of the earmark. The earmark process has grown tremendously over the past 10 years, and basically members of committees, especially appropriations committees, and Mr. Cunningham is on the appropriations committee, are allowed to be advocates for certain programs, and there is very little oversight, very little questioning, and frequently these earmarks are inserted at the very last moment in conference committees. I was told that sometimes earmarks are inserted at midnight. Bills are produced that have thousands of them, and then 10 hours later at 10 o'clock in the morning, the House is expected to vote, clearly without any time to provide any oversight or to question what is being inserted. Mr. Cunningham also was able to help in some programs. ADCS was not, document conversion was not classified, but he was able to, as a member of the Intelligence Committee, come up with programs that were shielded because they were regarded as classified, and then he could walk them over, as I was told by one former House aide, walk them over to appropriations and say, hey, I have a really good program. I can't tell you about it, but you should fund it. And then he could tip off his favorite defense contractors.
So Mr. Wilkes, then, the number one conspirator, not indicted as yet, but mentioned in the Cunningham indictment, was able to take advantage of that system. How then did Mr. Wilkes live?
He lived like a king, Warren. He started out with not much money, and actually we were told in the early 90s he didn't even have a car for a while. He accumulated a fleet of vehicles and had ready access to a corporate airplane. He had a hospitality suite first at the Watergate here in Washington, then at the Westin. He lived opulently. He had a taste for expensive cars, expensive wine, expensive meals, and very expensive travel. He cashed in big time.
In the process, he contributed to a lot of congresspeople other than Mr. Cunningham. Who were they?
They were primarily members of appropriations committees. And because of the network he was in, they were primarily Republicans. I mean, of course, Republicans controlled the show running all the committees. Some Democrats got them as well. But those who control the real levers of power and the chairman, of course, of all the committees and subcommittees were Republicans, and they were the ones who were the most valuable allies to a guy like Wilkes, who I think was Republican by conviction or at least by habit for a long time.
All right. Many of them are under indictment, or excuse me, under investigation. I beg your pardon. None of them has been indicted. What is it that Randy Cunningham in particular did that made his acceptance of money criminal?
Well, he has acknowledged that he sought bribes. In other words, there was an explicit admission of a quid pro quo. Frequently, in what Brooks Jackson has described as honest graft, political contributions appear to be associated in time, if not in a direct cause and effect relationship, with actions by Congress. But that is a very, very difficult thing to establish, and the courts have set a very high bar of proof in order to establish bribery. But Mr. Cunningham has acknowledged, as a result of an overwhelming case put together by the federal investigators, he's acknowledged that he sought bribes in return for helping steer contracts to these contractors.
Isn't it also true that the money went directly to him rather than to his campaign committee? In most of the other cases involved, it goes to the committee, and as I understand it, that's not a crime.
In some cases, it went directly to him. In other cases, it was funneled through businesses controlled by unindicted co-conspirators number 3 and 4 in New York.
Jerry Kammer, once again, reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Copley News Service. Winslow Wheeler is a former Senate staff member. He's advised both Republicans and Democrats, and he's author of a book called Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Winslow Wheeler, welcome to you.
Hi, Orrin. How are you?
Interested in your take on what we've just heard from Jerry Kammer and how this system of earmarking is used, according to your argument, to actually sabotage the interests of defense.
Well, there's two problems, fundamental problems in the process. One is that all of this spending gets legislated without anybody looking at it. Duke Cunningham was able to thrust these contractors on the defense budget simply because he wanted them. Nobody bothered to look at the cost, look at the performance of the contractor. Nobody got any independent entity looking at them. And you can get a taste for how the quality of these contractors by the nature of their profits. Mr. Kammerer talked about the huge skimming that the CEOs were engaging in for their own self-benefit, and also the huge amounts or percentages of the contracts spent for Mr. Cunningham and Lord knows who else. There's a more pernicious aspect to it, however, which is how Congress pays for all this junk. Republicans, Democrats, liberals, conservatives, moderates all engage in this earmarking process, and they all seek not to have these items looked at in any serious way. They pay for it not by adding money to the defense budget, but by raiding other accounts. One of the accounts they love to raid, an account that people pay little attention to, is the operation and maintenance account, the very same account that pays for training, ammunition, spare parts, maintenance, gasoline, food, and so on. In other words, these people were raiding the accounts that pay for the combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan to pay for these goodies, to get commodes, Rolls Royces, and so on for members of Congress.
So you're suggesting then that the money is directly taken away from troops in combat at risk defending the United States in order to pay for the stuff we've heard about.
Like the connection made between the payment of money and the understanding of the recipient, it's hard to draw a line between the two. However, if you look at the backs of these appropriations bills, the general provisions sections, you'll see that they add money to various accounts to pay for these things, and they take money out of various accounts to pay for these things. And the net result is that after thousands, quite literally a couple thousand of these things in each defense appropriations bill, after they're all added, costing anywhere up to about $10 billion per year these days, the bill doesn't grow by that amount. They pay for it by whacking other accounts.
Winslow Wheeler, once again, formerly with the Senate, as a staff member, has advised both Republicans and Democrats, offer of wastrels of defense. Back to Jerry Kammerer with the Copley News Service. Mr. Wheeler has been saying the kinds of things we've just heard him say for a long time. He's got a lot of documentation in his book. Your newspaper has reported a great deal of this as well. What appears to be going on Capitol Hill in response?
Well, I think Wheeler, who has been pointing this out for Mr. Wheeler for a long time, and I have his book right in front of me, and I visited him at his home early on and began the mentoring process. I'm very grateful to him. He has been sort of a voice crying out in the wilderness, and he's finally being heard in large part because of what we're learning about the audacity of the corruption of Mr. Cunningham. We have an earmarking process that has been going on unchecked and that has been tapped by a series of contractors who go for earmarks the way people used to rob banks because that's where the money is. And there are members of Congress and lobbyists who are facilitating the process.
Winslow Wheeler, back to you. Is it any worse in recent years than it was in the years previous to the time when the Republicans took over Congress, 1994?
Oh, definitely, but don't blame it on just the Republicans. I started working on Capitol Hill in the early 1970s. Back then, a defense appropriations bill would have about, maybe 100 or maybe tops 200 of these items in it. And they would be described in a paragraph in the committee report. They don't have enough paper these days to spend a whole paragraph on each of these things. Last year's bill had in excess of 2,000 of these items in it, and they're not described in paragraphs. They're simply a line item in tables. And these tables go on for page after page after page in the reports to these bills. It's not just the Appropriations Committee. It's also the House and Senate Armed Services Committee that willfully and happily engages in the process. And if you look at roads, courthouses, whatever, it's a process that's fulsome in those bills, too. The problem here is it's going on in defense bills, and it's causing a real problem with the accounts that need not to be raided.
Back to Jerry Kammer. Tell us a little bit more about some of the other congressmen who apparently have been the beneficiaries of this earmarking process. We've heard a lot about the former majority leader, Tom DeLay, and trips to Scotland and that sort of thing. Are they associated, or do they appear to be associated, with this earmarking process?
Well, there is a connection in that Mr. Wilkes, the unindicted co-conspirator about whom we were speaking earlier, set up a lobbying operation called Group W Advisors here in Washington. They hired as lobbyists the Alexander Strategy Group, the chief executive of which is a man named Ed Buckham, who was Tom DeLay's former chief of staff. This appears to be part of what is known as the K Street Project, in which Mr. DeLay is getting the word out to industry that if you want us to play ball with you, in what you're seeking from Congress, you need to play ball with us through the lobbying process. And, Warren, if I might just add quickly, I do think that sometimes those who seek earmarks are doing it for the most honest of reasons. They're young startup companies who find that they can't penetrate the Pentagon bureaucracy, and they think that the only way that they can get attention is to go seek congressional sponsorship. Duncan Hunter of San Diego has said, you know, sometimes they have a legitimate beef and a good technology, need help with the Pentagon, and that that is a legitimate thing for us to do as those who control the Pentagon budget.
Thanks for that. Important point. Winslow Wheeler, back to you. On the other hand, you said that since the 1970s, the earmarks have gone from 100 to 200 in the Defense Appropriations Bill to something like 2,000. What percentage of those, would you say, were there for what Jerry Kammer just called honest reasons?
The basic problem is nobody knows. The fundamental problem with the support system is that people aren't interested in finding out the real cost of these projects or their real quality. They don't ask GAO to look into the contractor and his product. They don't ask CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, to look into the cost. These items are added because somebody wants them, not because they are good. There are surely some good ones, and there are surely just as surely as there are some bad ones. The problem is, nobody knows which is which.
Winslow Wheeler, again, formerly with the Senate staff, advisor to both Republicans and Democrats, author of Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. Thanks to you. Thanks also to Jerry Kammer, a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Copley News Service. We'll continue this conversation after a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Hugo Chavez takes total control in Venezuela. What does that mean for the U.S.? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Democrats controlled the Congress for 40 years until 1994, when Republicans took over, in part because of financial scandals on Capitol Hill. Now one anonymous Republican aide has told the Washington Post, took the Democrats 40 years to get as arrogant as we have become in 10. Bruce Bartlett worked for both the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's now a syndicated columnist who has written recently about what he calls the creeping corruption of the Republican Party. Bruce Bartlett, welcome to you.
Happy to be here.
We've just been hearing from San Diego and from Washington about Randy Duke Cunningham and the process of earmarking and the way that that works in the Congress. We heard that there's a lot more of this in the past 10 years than there have been in the past. Is that what you mean by creeping corruption?
Well, what I was trying to get at was the kind of the intellectual corruption. I mean, there have been people like Randy Duke Cunningham around for a long time who just lined their own pockets. There was the case of Dan Rostenkowski a few years ago.
Democrat, of course.
Yeah, I don't see – that isn't really what I was getting at. I'm thinking more in the sense that here you have these Republicans who were elected to shrink government, to reduce the size of government, and they're just throwing money at any constituency that they think can be bought. And it seems to me that kind of corruption, the corruption of your principles, the corruption of everything you claim to stand for, is a deeper and more disturbing kind of corruption than the petty sort of stuff that people like Cunningham were involved in.
One of the things we just heard was that since the 1970s, there has been an increase in earmarks in the Defense Department budget from 100 to 200 a year to in the neighborhood of 2,000. What about that, particularly in the Defense Department budget? And since September 11th, when there's been such an effort to increase defense for various reasons, do you think there's a taking advantage of concerns about national security?
Well, I think that that they use whatever vehicle suits their purpose. I mean, one of the things that got Randy Cunningham in trouble is that he was making earmarks for specific contracts to specific companies that were paying him off. So it was straightforward bribery. I certainly have no trouble believing that there's been a vast increase in the number of earmarks. Groups like Citizens Against Government Waste have documented that there are far more earmarks and pork barrel projects of all kinds throughout the budget than there were before 2001. I think it's the combination of a Republican president and a Republican Congress that is really at the root of the problem, plus the fact that this president won't veto anything. I think it's just absolutely extraordinary that 5 years into this administration, President Bush has not vetoed one single solitary bill. You have to go back all the way back to John Quincy Adams, 1824 to 1828, to find a president who served an entire term, full four-year term, without vetoing a single bill. And that's one of the big problems.
Well, you, Bruce Bartlett, served this president's father, served also the Ronald Reagan administration. Are you concerned about your party?
Oh, absolutely. I think that things like the Abramoff scandal fit in very much with the sort of thing you're talking about, because what happens is when you lose track of your principles, when you don't stand for anything except just getting reelected, then it becomes very easy to say that let's do this spending project because it helps my friends, and it becomes a matter of connections. And I think that a true conservative would say, hey, these programs are bad on their face. We shouldn't be expanding them. You're a nice guy, and I like to help you out, but I'm not going to violate my principles by supporting a program that is bad. And once they've lost their principles, that anchor is gone.
And very quickly, Jack Abramoff, a lobbyist with ties to the former majority leader Tom DeLay, financed a lot of trips for various congresspeople, was involved as a representative of various Indian tribes. Tell us a little bit more, if you will, about how you think he is so illustrative of what you're talking about.
Well, when I first met Jack Abramoff, it was like 25 years ago, and he was one of the foot soldiers in the Reagan Revolution. He came to Washington in 1980, and he became head of the College Republicans and was very much involved in trying to implement the kinds of philosophical changes that Ronald Reagan talked about, and he's just completely gone off the rails. It's just all about putting as many dollars into his own pocket as possible. I've seen figures in the paper that he brought in more than $80 million at one point. And he was doing crazy things like financing anti-gambling interests so that he could get the gambling interests to pay him more to fight the anti-gambling interests that he himself was financing. I mean, this is just corruption pure and simple. But he wouldn't have gotten anywhere if it wasn't for this other problem I'm talking about, where, you know, a guy like Abramoff can go to a Tom DeLay and say, hey, I'm your pal, you know, we're both Republicans, help me out on this, and he would do it. DeLay was known for carrying around in his pocket at all times a little black book that had a listing of every lobbyist on K Street, which is the main place where all the lobbyists hang out in Washington, and whether they were a Republican or a Democrat, and he wouldn't even meet with the Democrats. So it was just all a matter of scratching, you know, my back, and I'll scratch yours, you know.
Bruce Bartlett, again, a nationally syndicated columnist, formerly with the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Ed Patru is a spokesperson for the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, and we're glad to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Bruce Bartlett talks about creeping corruption in the Republican Party, says there is an intellectual corruption that's going on. He's afraid that it will redound against Republicans in next year's election. What do you think?
Well, from a very practical perspective, I think that congressional races are really local phenomenons. Voters go to the poll and they are asking themselves, does my congressman or does my congresswoman deserve to be reelected? And ultimately, that's the decision that they're going to make at the polls. They're not going to ask themselves, you know, they don't vote Republican or Democrat. They vote strictly on their member of Congress. And, you know, looking back 10, 20, 30 years, I can't think of one member of Congress who lost an election for Congress based on an allegation, or even worse than an allegation, something that's been proven, of something somebody else may or may not have done.
So do you, though, concede that the problems that Bruce Bartlett has just outlined are, in fact, the case?
I think it's very difficult to hang ethics around Republicans, just as it was difficult to hang, you know, before any of this Abramoff started, it was difficult to hang ethics around the necks of Democrats. I mean, the fact is that every time Republicans or every time Democrats want to point the fingers at Republicans and say, look at Jack Abramoff, or look at Duke Cunningham, we're more than happy to point the finger back and say, look at, for example, Nancy Pelosi, who, as far as I know, is the only leader in Congress to have been fined by the FEC for illegally having two PACs so she could double the money she gave to Democrats. Or look at William Jefferson, who had both his home and office raided by the feds, and they discovered, you know, large amounts of cold, hard cash literally in his freezer.
Again, Ed Patru speaks for the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. Back to Bruce Bartlett. Two questions having to do with the impact of all of this. Before we get to that, what about when the Republicans first took over Congress in 1994? There was a scandal then having to do with kiting of checks at the banks that were maintained for the Congress on Capitol Hill. Didn't the Republicans then say they were going to clean all that up?
Well, yes, and they did to a large extent. The problem is that it didn't last for very long. And I would just respond to the previous speaker by saying that, generally speaking, what he's saying is true. Politics are local, and people do tend to support their own congressmen, even when they're down on the party or Congress in general, except that every once in a while that changes. I mean, all those congressmen who got a Republican congressman who got thrown out of office in 1974 because of Watergate, they didn't have anything to do with Watergate, but they got punished because of it anyway. And in 1994, as you say, the Republicans running for Congress nationalized that election and did make the idea of corruption of the Democratic Party a major campaign issue. And a lot of analysts, including me, believe that it was very substantially important in terms of allowing the Republicans to take control of the House and the Senate for the first time in 40 years. So I just think that you ignore these things at your own peril, because every once in a while people do care about ethics.
So, Ed Patru, what about that history? And is there a possibility that next year the Democrats might be able to nationalize the election in the way Bruce Bartlett describes?
Well, I'll say a couple of things about what Mr. Bartlett said, and then I'll respond to your question about nationalizing the elections. There are some major differences between 1994 and this year in terms of, you know, the ethics issue. And I could name a number of things, but I think first and foremost is the fact that, you know, the banking scandal was really something that was easy to digest for most voters. I mean, most voters understand what it means to overdraw an account. Most voters understand what was going on. It was easy to, you know, to present that sort of to voters in a nice, small, easy to understand package. Whereas this year, you know, the allegations that are being brought against Mr. Abramoff, they're a little bit more difficult to prove, and they're a little bit more difficult to explain. Nobody, at least most voters, don't really know who Jack Abramoff is, certainly don't know who Scanlon is, and so it's a difficult, more difficult case for you know, the Democrats to make.
But they certainly know who Randy Duke Cunningham is now, and they understand $7,000 antique toilets and Rolls Royces, and they know about all of the trips, the golfing trips and all that kind of thing.
Sure, they understand that Duke Cunningham did something illegal, and they understand that he's no longer in Congress. They understand that that problem was dealt with. But, you know, along the lines of the trips, and then I'll answer your question about the national tide or the national wave that the Democrats are trying to build. Look, I mean, the trip issue is certainly not something that Democrats can point the finger about. And, you know, this is really a case of throwing stones from a glass house, because the fact is that there are dozens of Democrats who have accepted similar trips, and many Democrats who had trips taken by lobbyists. And Steny Hoyer is one of them, who's, you know, one of the highest ranking members in the Democrat caucus in the House. You know, you asked about the national wave. The difference between 1994 and this year, in terms of the Democrats' effort to duplicate what Republicans did in 1994, what they are missing, I think, by and large, is an alternative agenda. It's not enough, even if Democrats were successful in creating a national wind, which, you know, they've tried for years and years to do that. In 2001, they talked about high gas prices. They talked about the quote-unquote Bush recession. They talked about corporate corruption. You know, many things that they've thrown up against the wall, sort of, in hopes that something would stick, that they can nationalize the elections around. But the difference is that in 1994, Republicans really had a substantive alternative, and we're not seeing that from Democrats today. I mean, I don't think there's, you know, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any of your listeners who can tell you what the Democratic Party stands for today, and the reason for that is because Democrats themselves don't know what they stand for.
Ed Petru, again, with the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. Back to Bruce Bartlett, our Republican syndicated columnist. My impression was, when you talked about intellectual corruption at the outset of our conversation, you were also suggesting that the Republicans have failed to accomplish their own agenda, in part because of what you call creeping corruption. Is that right?
Well, that's right. I think that the issue really isn't the kind of Randy Duke Cunningham or even the Jack Abramoff corruption. It's the total betrayal of their principles, you know, signing into law vast increases in Medicare spending at a time when we're already in deficit, you know, vast amounts of pork barrel spending, the bridge to nowhere, all that kind of stuff. But I would just say on the other point, though, that while it's true that the Democrats have not figured out how to capitalize on this issue, it would be a mistake to just ignore them as hopeless, because I think that that's the way you lose elections, is by not taking your opponent seriously. And I would point out that just yesterday, John McCain said on Meet the Press that a large number of additional indictments are coming down the road. And I think that there's a great danger that this scandal involving Jack Abramoff could end up you know, tarring all the Republicans, and even if it just ends up tarring all of Congress, because they're the governor of the ruling party, they're going to suffer the most if people just decide to throw all incumbents out.
Still with us from the earlier part of our program, Winslow Wheeler, who served both Republicans and Democrats on the staff of the Senate, and author of Wastrels of Defense. Heard from him earlier on our program. Very interested in your take on what Ed Petru said, that what people care about in Congress are local issues, and what they want is for a congressman who brings home the bacon. Isn't there a lot of truth to that? And doesn't that make it very difficult for these kinds of issues to be used in the way Bruce Bartlett suggests they might, to, in a way, punish people of the same party for what others have done?
Warren, I don't buy it. I think we heard a lot of whistling past the graveyard. It is true that all politics are local. That was a Tip O'Neill statement. But also there are national trends. Sometimes they're glacial, but once they get moving, they become very powerful, as in Watergate in 1974, and the problem Clinton had in 1994. There's two ways out of the hole. One way is to throw more mud, and we heard that when we heard people saying, "Well, the other guys do it too, so you shouldn't pay any attention to us." The right way out of the hole is to try to fix the problem. To ask your ethics committee in the House and the Senate to look into these and other inferred charges. So far, that's not been done by the Republicans or by the Democrats. And the way is the way out of the hole is also to clean up the process, the pork process. Nobody is interested in that. And that is truly an area where both Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives are all engaged in the process and gleeful to continue it. They think it's in their political interest to tout bringing home the bacon while forgetting to mention to the voters how it all got paid for.
Let me go back to Ed Patrou. Last opportunity we have for this segment of our program. What about that? The Republicans, whatever else you can say, are certainly in charge of the Congress. Are they going to mobilize the Ethics Committee? Are they going to deal with this earmarking process and try to do it before the next election?
Sure. I mean, I think Republicans have been moving to do that for some time. I think if you look at, if you look at congressional approval as a whole, if I have to disagree with some of your other some of the other comments that were made, if you look at polling that's been done on the congressional level, there really is no indication that there's any difference, at least among the public perception, between Republicans and Democrats on the issue of ethics. It's within the margin of error.
But isn't that just saying, as it was just suggested, that the other guys do it too? Therefore, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately the issue. The Democrats are trying to politicize this issue, and they're trying to say, you know, vote against Republicans, vote for Democrats, because we're somehow, we're more to be trusted on the issue of ethics than Republicans are. A lot of voters remember what happened when Democrats were in charge. And in addition to that, voters are really looking, if you ask a voter what's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat on ethics, and a voter doesn't see that, doesn't see much of a difference, I'm not sure how you can argue that benefits Democrats at all.
All right. We will see what happens in the near future, both in terms of what's done on Congress to deal with these issues and how it shakes down with voters come next November. Thanks, all of you, for being with us. Ed Patrou, Republican Congressional Campaign Committee staffer, Bruce Bartlett, nationally syndicated columnist, Winslow Wheeler, author of Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security, and, of course, Jerry Kammer of the Copley News Service, our earlier guests, thanks to him as well. President Hugo Chavez now controls all seats in Venezuela's National Assembly after the opposition boycotted yesterday's election. More in a moment on what that means for the U.S. and its influence in Latin America on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're not only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Since Hugo Chavez was first elected in 1998, there have been coup attempts and other efforts to remove him from power. Now, though, he controls all the institutions of Venezuela's government. Phil Gunson writes from Caracas for The Economist, The Miami Herald, and Newsweek magazine. Phil, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much.
What happened here? The result of the boycott was that Hugo Chavez was able to basically take over the National Assembly with just 25% of the voters of Venezuela. Now he runs everything. What did the boycotters get out of that?
That's a very good question, one that a lot of people are asking down here. The opposition, as usual, is split over this, and there were many doubters within the opposition ranks as to whether it was a good idea to go ahead and boycott. But in the end, I think what most counted, what most weighed on their minds, was the fact that there's so much lack of confidence on the part of the voters that had they gone into the election, they would likely have come out of it with such a small minority in the assembly that it almost didn't make any difference.
So, in other words, they felt the results were fixed before the election even began?
Yes. The problem is that the Electoral Council, what's known as the CNE down here, is very definitely dominated by the government. The people who run it are, without a doubt, in their overwhelming majority, people who are sympathetic to the government. And the feeling is that over the past few years, the electoral system has become less and less reliable as a way of really reflecting what goes on in the country. The country's split, perhaps not quite down the middle, but one way or another, it's usually... the polls usually suggest that there's about a 60-40 split in favor of the president. That was certainly what came out of a recall referendum that the opposition called for and lost in the end in the middle of last year. But that was not going to be reflected by any means in the assembly, partly due to the tricky nature of electoral law down here, which allows apparent constitutional guarantees of proportional representation to be flouted, and partly because the rules are set up in such a way and are interpreted in such a way that the opposition usually loses out.
So now, as I understand it, Mr. Chavez can be in control, stay in control of the government until 2013. That's a long time from now. He's already been there, of course, as long as any other leader in Latin America, except for Fidel Castro. What does that mean for the United States?
Well, of course, Hugo Chavez has set himself up as the principal opponent of the United States, perhaps these days even more important than Fidel Castro himself, and just about on every issue that the United States considers important in the region, Hugo Chavez is on the other side. He's on the other side in terms of free trade. He's on the other side in terms of relations with Cuba. He's on the other side in terms of the conflict in Colombia, for example, next door. And all these things make for a very uncomfortable relationship with the United States, somewhat complicated by the fact that, of course, Venezuela is a major oil producer and supplies what's usually around 13% of U.S. domestic oil imports. So what the outcome is a very difficult conundrum for the United States, which wants to continue receiving the oil but would very much like to reduce Chavez's influence in the neighborhood.
Phil Gunson, once again, freelance journalist, reporting from Caracas, Venezuela. Well, what about Chavez? Is he looking for someplace else to sell the oil?
He is. He's looking to sell it everywhere from the immediate neighborhood, in other words, South America, the Caribbean, to as far afield as China. And he'd very much like to reduce the dependency because, of course, the dependency, whilst the United States is to some extent dependent on Venezuelan oil, Venezuela is much more dependent at the moment on the U.S. market. So it's a two-way street. And Chavez would like to reduce that dependence, but it's not terribly easy, not least because Venezuela has a large chain of refineries in the United States and distributes a lot of its oil domestically on its own account and is somewhat tied in to that market. It's not an easy thing to turn around overnight.
What about some of the major players in Latin America, for example, Brazil? And how does Chavez relate to Brazil? What consequences might there be there if there's a relationship of importance for the United States?
Well, relations with Brazil are nominally quite good. Chavez always speaks very warmly of Lula, who, of course, is another one of the presidents who've come to power recently in recent years in Latin America or on the left of the political spectrum. But there are two factors there. One principal factor, perhaps, is the fact that Lula himself is in deep trouble over a major corruption scandal, which has seriously weakened his government, and that Brazil, in general, is by no means so hostile as to U.S. free trade initiatives as Venezuela is. Brazil would like to modify the free trade deal that's on offer, but it's by no means totally hostile as Chavez is. Chavez would throw out completely the free trade area of the Americas. In a sense, at the moment, Argentina is a much closer ally of Chavez. It seems much closer ideologically and practically to Venezuela than Brazil is.
Really don't have a lot of time left, and I'm not able to go into the issue regarding Argentina without first coming to this other issue. Maybe we'll have time for Argentina, maybe we won't. But if Chavez has the support of 60% of the people in Venezuela, that's a lot of people. Why is it that they do support him, and what now are the alternatives for the opposition?
Well, as far as his support goes, at the present time, he's suffering a bit of a dip. He rose sharply in the polls earlier this year, and some polling organizations were giving him 70% support. Most of them are now giving him lower than 50% support. So his personal standing has dropped quite a bit. And more importantly, perhaps still in terms of the, and certainly in terms of these latest elections, is that his government is not popular at all. People mostly see the government as inefficient, corrupt, and they're not really prepared to go out and vote for anybody except Chavez. It's very much a one-man show.
So again, then, based on that, what about Argentina? What sorts of trouble might there be for the United States if there's a close relationship there?
Well, Argentina is perhaps not the most immediate concern of the United States. I think the most immediate concern is Bolivia, which goes to the polls for presidential elections on the 18th of this month, and where there's a very strong likelihood that a man called Evo Morales, who is a radical who's very close both to Chavez and to Fidel Castro, may come to power. That is one thing the United States is looking at very nervously. And if an axis were to develop between Havana, Caracas, and La Paz, Bolivia, I think the U.S. would be even more concerned than it is right now. There's not much it can do to stop the process. And at the moment, George Bush is pretty unpopular in Latin America. And it's a fairly even fight, I think, between the U.S. And Venezuela, despite the enormous disparity in resources.
Fascinating issues that we don't hear enough about in this country. We'll try to come back and revisit this question of United States relations in Latin America as soon as we can. In the meantime, Phil Gunson, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Freelancer based in Caracas, Venezuela, writes for The Economist, The Miami Herald, and Newsweek magazine. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Cameron Radziner and Sharon Rimbaum, technical director is John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.